Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island, pairing beer and music since 1988. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago, Illinois. Listen critically, enjoy responsibly.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and later in the show, we'll review Phoebe Bridgers' new album, Punisher. She was on the show a couple of years ago playing songs from her debut, Stranger in the Alps, and since then, she's been everywhere. First with the group Boy Genius, with Lucy Dacus and Julian Baker, then with Better Oblivion Community Center, a collaboration with her and Connor Oberst of Bright Eyes, but that's all later in the show. First, a classic album dissection. We're going to dig deep into Bill Withers' Live at Carnegie Hall, first released in 1973.
Sometimes in our life, we all
Greg, we have been talking about doing a classic album dissection of Bill Withers live at Carnegie Hall for some time. Unfortunately, Bill passed on March 30th at the age of 81 of cardiovascular disease. We are overdue to dive into this classic album.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. He made many fine records in the early 70s at the start of his career. But I think the signature record is Bill Withers Live at Carnegie Hall, which was released in April of 1973, Jim. And to me, if you want a one-stop shopping of what Bill Withers was all about, this is the record for you. I also think it's one of the greatest live albums ever made. Forget artist, forget genre, forget about era. You know, this is one of those records that holds up over decades.
Oh, absolutely. And I have you to thank, because I had my obligatory Bill Withers' Greatest Hits collection, and that was what my Withers collection was. And then you kept drumming into me the greatness of this album. And I'm an anti-live album, generally speaking. But what a fascinating story. Let's start with who this guy was. Bill Withers, born on the 4th of July. How much more American can you get? 1938 in West Virginia, where he grows up. As a young teen, a middle teen, he enters the U.S. Navy, spends almost a decade working as an aircraft mechanic. When Bill Withers emerges from the service, Greg, he settles in San Jose, California for a time, has a couple of odd jobs. At one point, he's a milkman before he winds up back in the aircraft industry. And that makes it sound, those two words, aircraft industry, makes it sound way more glamorous than it was. Bill Withers' job was installing the toilets in jetliner bathrooms. You know, mm-hmm. Probably the least favorite part of an aircraft that anybody's ever experienced. The story goes that he goes to see Lou Rawls performing at a club in Oakland, California, and he is struck as much by the music as the fact that Mr. Rawls seems to be doing very good business that night with a full house.
I went down to St. James Infirmary.
And Bill Withers decides to begin working on his songwriting abilities. He puts out a one-off single in 1967 that isn't really part of the story. Saturday night in a Harlem, everything's all right. Voodoo, do the skate, sing a lick, party's out of sight. Sunday morning, here in a Harlem, everybody's all dressed up. But he moves to L.A. and then decides to get serious. He records a demo with the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band.
Express yourself.
It's a serious studio. It's an impressive demo. One of the band members is impressed enough to take it to Stax Records and begin playing it. He doesn't wind up at Stax. He winds up at Sussex Records. And this label pairs him with Booker T and the MGs for his debut album, Just As I Am, in 1971. Not only has he got most of Booker T and the MGs, one of the greatest backing bands in history on that record, he's got people like Stephen Stills of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and Jim Keltner, the great studio drummer.
Saturday night in the Harlem, everything's all right.
But still, nobody quite knows what to do with this music coming out of Bill Withers. He's 33 when that debut comes out. I mean, that's old in pop music terms. The first single comes out with Harlem on the A side, but DJs begin playing the B-side. And that's where the Bill Withers story really starts, because that B-side is Ain't No Sunshine.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away.
Becomes a big hit. The man is on the map with a third of his life already behind him. The follow-up album is even more successful. It's only a year before Still Bill comes out. That's got two hits at the top of the charts. Following up Ain't No Sunshine, we get Lean On Me and Use Me. Bill Withers is at the top of his game. And on October 6th, a Friday night, he plays Carnegie Hall. You know, the old joke. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? You practice, you practice, you practice. And if you're Bill Withers, you spend 33, 34 years at that point learning your game. It's apparently a miserable night. You know, autumn in New York, they talk about, right? But no, this is one of those cold, wet, dreadful nights, not fit for beast nor fowl. And on Live at Carnegie Hall, Bill Withers is thanking people continually for coming out in this weather.
Appreciate y'all coming out in this rain.
Yeah, it's not a very forgiving night for, you know, the audience, but they show up in droves. They fill up 3,600-seat Carnegie Hall, which amazed Withers and his band and his managers and his record company, all of whom thought it was a bad idea to book Carnegie Hall. Up until this point, he'd basically been playing clubs like the Bitter End and the Troubadour in L.A., and he'd been an opening act for people like Blood, Sweat, and Tears or Jethro Tull whenever he did play larger places. So this was a big step for him.
Well, and there's some hubris there, you know. I mean, no, Carnegie Hall is the premier concert venue in New York. I found a review from when the concert happened saying, you know, what happened here? Did the Apollo Theater move south?
You know, it was one of those things where the audience became a part of the show in a big way because of Withers' magnetism.
I just call lonely brother when you need a hand. We all need somebody to lean on.
Now, Still Bill, the second album, had been released in May of 72. And I think what's key to this record is that he had retooled his band by the time Still Bill came out, that studio album with the two big hits on it. You know, he had basically taken the core of the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band, which had backed funk pioneer Charles Wright on hits like Do Your Thing and Express Yourself.
Express yourself. Express yourself.
And made them his band. So they had been playing together on the road in these clubs and recorded this studio album. So they were quite primed for this show. Benoist Blackman on guitar, Melvin Dunlap on bass, Ray Jackson on piano and strings, James Gatson on drums, the great James Gatson. And I once talked to Withers, and he talked to me about, you know, this band would rehearse constantly. They were rehearsing in James Gatson's garage. And Withers used to joke around with the guys. You guys were the original garage band, you know? You know, very proficient musicians, but they were doing it old school, you know, getting ready for going on the road or cutting a record by playing together in real time in their garage. So by this point, they had developed a real chemistry. In James Gatson's garage, they became a great band together, backing up Bill Withers' thing. They added a percussionist for this particular date, Bobby Hall, who was just a child prodigy. Had played with everybody in Motown, The Temptations, Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder, Smokey Robinson. The one thing I need to add, Jim, here is that besides this amazing band, as we know, there was a lot of sort of gimmickry done with a lot of so-called live albums in the 70s. Live wasn't really live because sometimes the entire album, except for the audience applause, would be recut in the studio and passed off as a live album. In this case, this was very much a live recording, except occasionally you hear a horn or a string part that comes in. Those were overdubbed later. I was disappointed to find that out years ago, that not everything was live on this record. It would have been amazing if they'd had an orchestra present in the room, but they couldn't afford one at the time, I'm sure. They did overdub some strings and horns in L.A.
It was Carnegie Hall. You'd think there'd be an orchestra just laying around, you know?
Yeah, no kidding. But it doesn't detract from the record at all. The core of the record, Jim, is Withers interacting with that audience and with that band in real time.
No, and it just builds and builds and builds. The feedback loop, the energy going in all three directions, Bill to the band, to the audience back. You know, I think the best way, Greg, to deal with what originally were four sides of vinyl LP is to talk about some of the songs. And I wanted to start with the opening track, Use Me.
Hey, hey, you.
Now, it was a hit at that point for Withers.
I want to spread the news that if it feels it's good getting used, oh, you just keep on using me until you use me up.
It becomes, as everything does on Live at Carnegie Hall, it becomes something different. It's looser, it's funkier, it's more soulful, more immediate in the recorded version, I think, than even on the album version, which is great for sure. You know, Bill Withers, I think because Lean On Me is such a powerful and emotional song, many people think of him as looking always on the bright side of life. But this is a man who has done a lot of living by age 33. And Use Me is a song that is about a sexual relationship where he feels these partners are using each other, that he feels he's being used. You really do abuse me. You get me in a crowd of high-class people, and then you act real rude to me.
You're like you're getting me among your high-class friends. Uh-huh. Hey, hey, and you act real rude to me. Uh-huh.
Robert Christgau, the great critic, called it one of the few knowledgeable songs about sex that our supposedly sexy music has ever produced. It's also a song about class. You know, now suddenly he's a star, and he's, by all accounts of his life story, he's enjoying being a star. But you now have time for me that I have money and stardom, but you didn't before when I was installing toilets in the airplanes, right? There's, you know, some bitterness, cynicism. I don't know what the word is. You know, he knows human nature. He knows the good stuff and he knows the bad stuff. And we have to talk about Use Me. I don't think he's had a song that's been covered or sampled more. I mean, listen to just a few of the folks who have covered Use Me. Grace Jones. Fiona Apple, D'Angelo, Ben Harper, Ike and Tina Turner, Isaac Hayes, Aaron Neville, and these are my two favorite, Liza Minnelli,
until you use me up,
and Hootie and the Blowfish. Show me a list anywhere else in pop music that diverse that has covered a song by anyone.
Yeah, it's an incredible version, Jim. It begins the record. You know, I'm not sure where it fell in the actual concert. I find it hard to believe that the concert opened with this moment, because it's almost like, where do you go from there, you know? But it's so amazing the way it transcends the studio version, especially the way Gadsden's drums, the way he would, you know, he'd say, baby, and then you hear that whack of that kick drum, and then baby, and then there's another whack from James Gadsden, and get it, James, get it, James. You know, he was exhorting his band to feel what he was feeling. And there's a reason I think this song resonates over the decades, is because love songs were traditionally very black and white. It was, you know, you're either in love or you're out of love. This is sort of an in-betweener, you know? And I think that's what Bill Withers was so great about, is just talking about those moments that are in those gray areas, you know? This isn't exactly right, but it doesn't feel wrong. It's like one of those things where human beings go through these kind of complex emotions.
You're absolutely right, and I think that love-hate, two-side, good relationship, bad relationship, toxic mix, right? I think you have to go to somebody like Mick Jagger to reach anything similar, especially in that era, a song like Angie or something, where I'm drawn to you, but you're destroying me.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. And Gadsden, yeah, I'll second that. What an incredible drummer.
Yeah, the band is incredible. I think, again, you hear the performance of that band as being part of who Bill Withers is. I think a lot of people may think, oh, a singer-songwriter plays that folk guitar, and that's kind of his pocket. And certainly that's where it begins, but I think the band just brings a whole other dimension to it on this record. What's interesting about this record, too, Jim, is I think a lot of live albums, and I think one of the reasons people look askance at them who value music, is that they're essentially glorified greatest hits collections. They're not really meant for any other purpose other than to be a placeholder in a band's career while they're biding time between the next studio album. Withers had only put out two studio records, so he didn't have a ton of music to draw on at this point in his career. What was fascinating about Live at Carnegie Hall is that he introduced like five songs on this record that had not been recorded, including the one that I'm going to focus on next, I Can't Write Left-Handed. This was a song that was never included on a Withers studio album, which boggles my mind because I think it's one of the strongest bits of songwriting he'd ever done. But I think maybe he also felt like it needed that audience interaction in order to become what it was.
We recorded this song on October the 6th. Since then, the war has been declared over. If you're like me, you'll remember it like anybody remembers any war. One big drag.
I just love those hymn-like, wordless backing vocals that set that haunting tone at the start of the song as he's talking about this young kid, this stranger in a strange land who was shot in the shoulder. And it's almost matter-of-fact in the telling of the story, but there's sort of a rage underneath that plain-spoken delivery. And he's talking about, you know, the fate of this kid who went over to Vietnam not really knowing what he was getting into and returning without a right arm. And, you know, I can't write left-handed is a simple plea. Like, this is affecting the way I live day to day.
Somebody says go, they don't ask any questions, they just go. And I can remember not too long ago seeing a young guy with his right arm gone. Just got back.
And Withers, you know, this was not a story that Withers had to imagine a great deal. I mean, he was in the military for 9 years, as you pointed out, Jim, and he knew these guys. He never saw combat, but he knew a lot of his friends who did. And this was part of that sort of memory experience that he brought to his songwriting, that, you know, drawing in on these tales that he remembered from growing up and being a young man, you know, a young African-American man in America during a tremendously tumultuous time in our country's history. So this song is so powerful emotionally, and I think the way they sort of build it up and interact with the audience as the song proceeds turns it into this, like, incredibly dramatic moment in the show and also one of the signpost moments of Withers' career.
Please write a letter to my mother. Tell her to tell her family lawyer. Trying to get a deferment for my younger brother. Tell the Reverend Harris to pray for me, Lord, Lord, Lord. I don't believe I'm going to live to get much older.
And again, as great as those singles were, I think this may be his single greatest song from my personal viewpoint.
Really? Even better than Ain't No Sunshine? You're going to go with...
I mean, those songs are great, and I love them to death, but I think I Can't Write Left-Handed. The impact of that song is just, it staggers me every time I hear it, especially in this, you know, with those haunting background harmonies. It just gets me every time.
Well, and the humility with which he introduces it. I mean, we have now had, by 72, quite a few years of anti-war anthems. And, you know, Withers raps with the audience, I think, are one of the reasons this album works. And usually I hate the audience chatter. But he says, you know, a lot of people write about wars and government. And he's almost apologizing for doing that. Of course, what he's writing about is humanity. And we feel the pain of this guy he's singing about.
And looking through rosy and rosy colored glasses, I must admit it seemed exciting in a way.
After a short break, we'll explore a few more tracks from Live at Carnegie Hall and talk about Withers' early retirement from music that he actually maintained up until his death this year. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Coming at you.